This is Betty Smith, May 16th, 1992. Finding the Voice of the Self. Tape 1 of 3.
I wanted you all to know Betty Smith as a mythologist.
Betty thinks of herself as a mythologist, not as she said last night, not a psychologist. And there's a world of difference. The longer you work with Jungian material, you know that this becomes almost the difference. She's also the founder and leader of the Poiesis seminars, which have been going on since the early 60s, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they meet in Malibu, where Betty lives, and also in Northern California. It would be wonderful if we could get a group going in Seattle sometime in the not too distant future, perhaps. So there could be a Poiesis group northwest. She also takes people to Greece, and after hearing her speak, I'm sure you can appreciate what the trips with her could mean. We have a tablet. I'll get it out, and you can put your name and address on it to hear information about Betty, about the trip, or anything else about any appearances she may be making, seminars she may be leading in any near vicinity. We'll get that information to you. This is her third visit to Seattle, to the Seattle Jung Society, and usually she does a two-day series like this, and it would be two consecutive days, rather than a lecture and a workshop. So this is a new format. But material that has been well loved and well worn by Betty before we get it. And that's probably the reason it's so wonderful when we do get it. Betty is also on the faculty of the C.G. Jung Institute in Los Angeles and has been there for quite a long time. So it's with real pleasure I welcome Betty Smith.
Thank you, Celia. Thank you. Actually, this is my favorite size group in a seminar, and I usually give two long summer seminars, about 6-day seminars, at Lake Arrowhead in Southern California in the San Bernardino Mountains, and I limit my summer seminar to 15 people because I like that number, and it's a particularly good working group. We may be turn out to be a few more than 15, but it's a number that works well. 12 to 15 is and it's also the number of my 12 is the number that I maintain for my Malibu women's group, which has been going for about 20 years. Occasionally adds a member and loses a member. Right. Now, what we're going to do today is, I think, fairly different from last night, for those of you who were here last night. It certainly, theme-wise, is connected with the oracle, with the voice of the self. The oracle not meaning merely a historic phenomenon, such as we were speaking of last night at Delphi in ancient Greece, in 700 B.C. to 400 A.D., that was given for its great imagery to us of the archetypal nature of approaching the self, of receiving a sense of message or counsel or direction from the deeper self, from the greater self. So that's why we were using the historic oracle. It wasn't just to be just for an informative purposes, although I realize there was a fair body of information last night. A few people told me it was quite a bit of information. what we want to do now is we're going to use some images from other oracles, but we're going to take time to explore those images to see what they mean to us individually, how the individual psyche receives these images, how it responds to them. Because if I don't find, or you don't find, with an image, the gateway for yourself, the gateway to your experience, the gateway that opens or helps you cross the threshold to the depths, to the archetypal connection, to the place of meaning, it's crossing that threshold that brings us a connection that we call meaning. Personal meaning. Well, And it's better, it's really better to fall in the beginning. It reminds me of that story that Lawrence Vanderpost told when he came to Los Angeles once. He said, when he finally got to the land of the Kalahari and discovered the tribe, which had been very elusive to him in the Kalahari Desert in Africa, with his group of European explorers with him, the people of the tribe were warm and dignified, and they kept them outside the boundary of their village for, I think, 24 hours. That's my memory of it. They sat with them, they smoked with them, passed the pipe, and explored, found out what kind of people these were, these foreigners who had come to their boundary. They didn't just say, y'all come on in. No. Because, in fact, I think this affected him very profoundly, Vanderpost, because it's a truer viewpoint of the psyche not to invite in what doesn't belong to you or that you can't handle. And so this was very important. But I haven't gotten to the point of the story. The next day, they invited him in. They decided these were people with whom they had a resonance. And so the Kalahari invited them in, and Vanderpost led the way, and he'd only gone in on the path a little way, and there was some enormous, like a block or something, stone in the path, and he pitched over it and fell headlong. And there was just a spontaneous laughter that went up among the Kalahari in their pure childlike response to it. He had to pick himself up, and then there was the same dignity as before with the Kalahari, and they let him in. But he felt that was apparently very important to that their visitor, that this should happen. He didn't say it was planned, but the fall made him realize that he was only a visitor, and that he had to bow. He had to bow the Western consciousness to come here. No, it's very important. So that's certainly a fall that happened at the beginning. But I think that this idea of threshold crossing is also very important. One should never be shoved across any threshold between conscious and unconscious. One should not be pushed or manipulated or shoved. One has to be summoned. One has to feel comfortable about, and that it is one's time and one's season to cross. And so I hope the images that we are going to work with today, that you'll bear this in mind, that there is natural resistance in oneself, and sometimes it's appropriate resistance. Sometimes it's habitual resistance that may have gone on too long and could move a bit, you know, that there is a way of receiving images appropriately that for oneself that could be beneficial. But only you know what's right for you and for your psyche. So we are going to deal with some images, and I also have, I have brought a couple of dialogues. This is yesterday's, the Heracles dialogue that I read last night. There's a certain position that I get out of hearing, isn't it? The Heracles dialogue that I read last night, where he stole the tripod from Apollo. The first part of it I didn't read to you, so you may want to skip over to the middle of over to the third page. Some of you asked to see some of the statements again, so I'll leave it out for your use for the day. I prefer that you not make a Xerox copy because it is going to be in a group to be published, I hope. That's my plan. So we're going to talk more specifically about the how to connect to the oracle, which means the bridge between the consciousness and unconscious. We're not using oracle as something outside that one consults, a book or a place or a person. But really as a bridge of connection to the self. There are two attitudes that are very important in dream work that I'll mention in the beginning or in any inner work. One is that you must always bring your own reality strength, your own relatedness to who you are and your life and your predicament, the simple facts and experiences of your life that surround you. Take your own context of your life. In other words, your familiar ego personality, but the self you know yourself to be. That must come and be presented in all inner work. It must always have a voice in inner work. And then the receptivity to what comes from the unconscious. I call the two-part attitude. The first part is a responsible, firm-footed, conscious attitude towards everyday reality. I've got my feet on the ground. I know who I am. I'm even such values as good sense and moderation and the things that, with which we live our daily life in order to get through it. That part has to be present. It can't absolutely dominate. That's the other problem, is when it dominates. And then the second is a receptive part of the attitude, a kind of what I call a tender night mind. A tender night mind. That is something that is open to the margins of my fantasy, the margins, my dream life would be night life, open to the place of longing, memories that haunt one, that have some old satisfaction that is gone, a sense of absence somewhere, of a connection, marginal things. The night mind picks these up. Yeah, and of course the night mind can happen in the daytime. We can engage that receptive part. It receives the dreams, will receive the unconscious. It can hear the non-rational, the non-familiar voices. Beg your pardon? No, it can hear. It can hear the non-rational, non-familiar voices. It always seems to me two parts. I notice in quite a few of Jung's letters how he'll remind someone. I'm thinking a particular letter he wrote to a woman who wrote him when he was on vacation in the summer. And it was, you'd never have the writer's letter. You have only Jung's response in these collections. So you have to infer what went before. And apparently she was quite caught up with her dreams, having great, glorious, splendid panorama of dreams. And he said, look, the unconscious is not a good father. You can't treat the unconscious as a good father that supplies you every day. He used that word, the good father. Said it has both sides, the unconscious. It can be a good father, but it can also bring you some things you have to be very wary of. And you need to have a stronger conscious viewpoint, he told her. You need to get your feet on the ground. You need to do something every day that steadies you and that connects you to your everyday world, too. And he obviously feared for her that she had kind of dived into the waters instead of taking it up bucketful by bucketful. Early in my own analysis, on my own analytical work, I remember a dream that frightened me very much of being on a raft on the sea. No sides, the raft on the sea. And waves washed up and there were sharks in the waves. Now they didn't come on the raft, but they were very frightening to me. And I think it scared my analyst pretty badly too. But she was able to kind of help me to I was too open to the unconscious. For that point in time, I was too weak in ego and too open. And so these things have to go. I'm not saying this to frighten you, but that there's often a rebalancing that's happening in our inner work. And later, when I got a dream, I don't remember how much later, sometime I think, I got a dream of standing at a well and drawing up water in a bucket, pool bucket, and a real sense of satisfaction in that dream. Well, I was in a better place by then, you see. I was standing on the ground. I wasn't head over heels in the well. And I was drawing up, yes. That's right. Thank you. That's very, very good connection, I think. Yes. Yep. Right. That's very helpful, Celia. And it's a very individual matter which side you need more of. You can't buy a book and just generalize. So that's this two-part attitude helps us. When the earliest seer in Greece, ancient Rome, the earliest seer in ancient Greece was Melampus from the south of Greece, came from Sandy Pebos, which is figures in the Odyssey. And as a young man, he had a brother, and as a young man, or really one presumed a teenager or something, he was out in the field at this favorite tree, and he saw a nest. He saw a servant of the family come up, and there was a nest of serpents in the tree, and the servant was killing the serpents, snakes. And Melampus rescued two of the baby serpents, baby snakes, and let them go free. Well, when he grew a little older, I don't know how long it takes for snakes to get from infancy to adulthood. Once in the night, there came through the window of his room two enormous snakes in the nighttime. And they came up and each licked an ear. His ears were licked by serpents and left. Oh, he knew that these were the ones he had saved, and this was their gratitude. And from that time forward, his ears were opened, as the ancients said, and he could hear the voices of all creatures. He could hear what the creatures said. He could understand the language from little insects up to bigger animals in the world. Yeah, you can imagine what that would be taken on an inner plane, to have that kind of opening to that, to all those marginal and lost voices in the collective or the deeper psyche. And then there are many stories about how he was called as a seer and brought the peace of wisdom to people. But this opening towards the unconscious, that's a threshold image, threshold story. And it is important to have enough opening or a significant opening if it comes to you. It rarely comes to us in that way, that significantly. Jung talks to us about, one other thing besides this two-part attitude as kind of basic to inner work and to dreams, is we need to cultivate the inner amplitude. I can't tell you which of his books he's used those words, but I thought they were really quite an extraordinary image they create. It's a very roomy idea, at the very least. You cultivate the inner amplitude. That is, you have a sense of welcoming the imaginal life, the imagination. Now, once again, I'm not talking about falling headlong into fantasy, but opening to the images that come getting off of the hard track that we put our minds and energies on. The hard track of accomplishment and getting the goal done and getting the routine accomplished. And it is very important to provide this amplitude. Some people need to do it it's very helpful to do it through something physical at times. I've seen some people do it through a kind of dance or body movement, if that were open to you. Others do it through maybe a kind of writing, journal-like writing, feelings or memories or reactions. It should be more than just emotional reactions, this inner amplitude room, but it would include that. And some can do it by exploring an art, not to do an art project, please, but to do something quite free in art, to let the color and the forms happen as one gets rather meditative or contemplative. These are just techniques, if you need technique. Receiving what's in the margins of one's mind, especially where sometimes an irritation comes up, there's a pattern of irritation or irritability. If under a pattern of irritability, something that just really sets one off regularly or whenever it happens, to look behind it, because often it speaks to something that's not satisfied, something in the desire nature which has been turned off. Maybe you'll come up with some examples, something like that. The inner amplitude is a provision that the psyche creates through some conscious cultivation, I believe. I believe this is what Jung is driving at. There's some conscious cultivation of this place or this time, place-time, to receive some of these responses. Now, I don't want to leave you with the notion that you always have to be doing a technique. I've actually been a person with using very few techniques, except for active imagination. That just happens to be my way. But some people can take a walk or can read a certain kind of material and it stirs the imagination. It stirs that room. It opens a broader room where things don't press in upon you. See, that's the reason for the space. Really, an awful lot presses in upon us all the time. So I feel very indebted to Jung for that idea of the inner amplitude. It's a safe place, this inner room. It's a place out of peril. A collective critical side wants everything out in the open or observable. And yet here's a place that's apart from the, either the critical or the terribly industrious side of oneself, or the over-pragmatic side. You can do something that's totally not useful in this room, and for which you cannot predict the future. It's a place for that. It doesn't mean you're going to live there 24 hours a day, by the way. This conscious, familiar footing will keep you from doing that. But a place that you can turn to, and it's very therapeutic, very solitary. There's a certain balance or health that is restored, I think, in being able to find that dwelling place. When I say dwelling place, I do mean an inner dwelling place. It doesn't have anything to do with one's outer address. It's true that certain places can help us get to it. You know, getting away from the routine or the routine place can help us get to it. But it is primarily an inner dwelling place with its own space. I know in my own case, when I had young children, and we lived apart from either family and in a strange city, and I had three little children, there was so much responsibility and aloneness with the children while my husband was at work. And I think it was a shock to my psyche sometimes. And there was no, it was very introverted personality. There was no inner amplitude that I could find. And I began to have a very intense fantasy life. Very intense. An ongoing fantasy started in the years with, I think it was before the third child was born. An ongoing fantasy that went on for many years and took me into analysis, actually, because I worried about the time that it wanted from me. It was so vivid and satisfying and interesting. It had an English setting, by the way. I'd never been to England at that point. Always had this English setting. And so it finally took me into analysis. But not until one day I cut off the fantasy. I had a strong enough will, I thought, and go to do that. I thought, this isn't good for me. So, yes, I get my daily work done. I do what I have to do. But this isn't good. And I had a terrible dream after this cutting. I dreamed of being in a small shop, and I entered this shop, and there stood a young man, a handsome young man, and I went up with a large knife, and I cut off his arms and then cut off his legs. I've never, ever had a violent dream. So that disturbed me enough. Sometimes things send us into our inner work. And I went into analysis, and Hilda Kirsch said to me, well, what have you done? What is it that you've done? Well, I didn't connect it with the fantasy, but I told her about the fantasy I had. I said, but I've cut it off now. Well, she said, there it is. There's the knife. She said, you can't do that to the unconscious for some reason. And she got me to write the fantasy down, which was the beginning of taking away its overgreat power, but at the same time, I gathered in time, I got the benefit of it, you understand? Got some of the quality and the benefit of it. Well, I needed an inner amplitude, and then analysis showed me how to develop that in time. So that's what I want to say in the beginning, but we'll say some more specific things later about working with dreams. Now, there are a couple of things in connecting to the self. There are two soul parts, I would call it, two aspects of soul that, according to this particular myth, play an important part. One of them is a part that runs away from everything. One is a part that runs away from everything. I'm sorry, I'm dropping my voice. Please ask me if you don't hear. She is the one who flees. In myths, she's always a maiden. The soul is represented as a maiden, whether in man or woman, I think. She flees, she withdraws, she is frightened. And then there is another side that is able to receive the fiery connection to life, that is able to love, is able to make a passionate connection. I find it very helpful in myth. You will see the love stories in myth that are very simple, between man and woman or between god and maiden. But also to see those on the inside is very important, as our essential soul life. And love and passion have to do with life connection, not just sexuality and physical desire. Those are part of it. Those are expressions of it. But it doesn't exhaust it. Now, this is a little story. Since last night we were with Apollo. This is a little story of Apollo right after he's born. And when a god is born, whether goddess or male god, the god is full grown, has full powers. Sometimes the poets represent them still with the naivete of childhood upon that one. But they have their full ability to, all their attributes are already present. Perhaps not fully full bloom, but present. So I followed that idea here. This is a dialogue, which means it's a kind of fantasy on the myth. And Leto was Apollo's mother. She's a great moon goddess. And so she is the mother of two children, Apollo and Artemis, the same conception. Their father is Zeus. Apollo and Artemis were twins, brother and great brother sister gods. Apollo says, "Step aside, mother. Don't you see that I am born?" And Leto said, "A little patience, child of mine. All still moves at Earth's knowing pace." And so Apollo, the child Apollo, bowed deeply to Mother Leto until his head rested upon the earth, showing his gratitude to Earth, and I guess to Leto, for his birth. Leto got up from the hard ground beside the palm tree and took her child in her lap. This is on the island of Delos. She smiled on his golden beauty and pondered the authority with which he had spoken already. And she said to him, "You've been long in coming, and long and harrowing has been the journey to find the ground that would receive Leto's child. And I don't plan to read the whole dialogue because I think we need to talk about some of these images. I hope you'll be thinking about this as an inner birth. This is the inner birth of the divine child that one can experience through this story. The story follows the myth. And Apollo says, "What are you telling me?" And his mother said, "That all the lands of men with their fine cities turned away Zeus and Leto's child." The child's face saddened. "Am I not the one destined to carry the light of Zeus? Ah, that light can be the bolt that shakes one mightily." "Never fear, mother. It is not mine to bear the thunderbolt. It is the light of Father Zeus's mind that I am to bring to the human world." "Ah, yes. That light is far in and quite hidden, I believe. It is rather like a spring flanked by mountain cliffs and plunging into a chasm." "Mother, you have spoken my wish. I shall seek just such a place for my sanctuary. Now I must leave you." "Not so soon," she said. "No? Who is this gracious lady who looks on me?" "This is great Themis, daughter of Earth herself. She is holder of the great oracle." "Greetings, Lady Themis." And again he bowed. "I want an oracle too," he said. "I saw several goddesses departing, and you two alone remain. Is the world populated with goddesses, mother?" "In part, yes," she said. "Then it is good that I have come, because I shall make a difference," Apollo said. And Themis speaks for the first time and says, "Leto, has your child uttered an omen with these words? For the moment he uttered them, they caused a shudder to pass through me." Now, especially these two things, "I want an oracle, too. And I shall make a difference in the world." And Themis said it caused a shudder to pass through her. Apollo says, "Strange, but the moment I came forth from the womb, two things assailed my newborn senses. The great, erect, brown body of the palm tree, which I took at once to be my mother." Both goddesses laughed at this. "And what was the other thing?" "I heard a voice from deep within the ground, and that voice laughed and continued laughing happily." Now, this is not part of the fantasy, of my fantasy. This is in the Homeric hymn to Apollo that the ground laughed when he was born. And his mother says, "Earth rejoices too at your coming forth. Yet that voice you heard would be my sister's, Asteria. This island is her ground, you see. At last, Asteria is joyous and no longer solitary." "This island is her ground? My aunt is an island?" "Yes. It is a long tale in which your father is the chief figure. Do tell me the tale. I want you to have just this much before you before we talk about it." Leto said, "All right. It's fitting that you should know about the devious root of God love. Well, Lord Zeus is mostly one who looks upon things from afar. And it happened that he had been observing the house of Helios." "My father," Leto said. "My father. That's Helios is, do you know who Helios is? The son." "Who is this Helios? a last child. He's the sun god. His attention came, Zeus's, to rest upon the daughters of Helios, and he came to admire both of us. I'm one of those daughters. He found Asteria to be especially interesting and well desirable. What was your sister like that Zeus preferred her? It's difficult for a sister to say, now that you ask. She had hair like a raven's wing that fell abundantly about her face. Her eyes were large and rather like ripe, unplucked olives. Her name meant the Star One, and it was well chosen. Was she nice? Asteria is a gentle soul. We called her Nocturnal One. We called her Nocturnal One, Nocturnal One, and she was very shy. And her name means star, and they called her Nocturnal One. Are there things to be shy of, Mother? Yes, indeed, especially when an Olympian god comes to take an interest in you. Asteria was shy of a god's passion, and when Zeus came to court her, she ran from the house and fled from him. He gave chase, of course. Why, of course? Leto said dryly, I don't know why, except that with Zeus it is, of course. Go on, please. What happened next? Now try not to interrupt me, lest I should forget something. On and on, Asteria fled from the face of great Zeus. But although human individuals are easily distracted from their purpose, Zeus never is. Besides, he was a swift runner because of his skill in racing across the sky with the lightning. Presently, Zeus drew close to Asteria, who was exceedingly frightened. There was nothing she might do to escape him except to take a different form. So she became a quail and took wing above. Life. And hearing his awesome voice shook Asteria, and at that moment she plunged downward to the sea and remained afloat on the sea. A quail afloat on the sea? No, she again changed form, and when Zeus looked down, he saw a small, barren island with one palm tree and a little lake on it, and it was a floating island. And Asteria came to be called the Isle of Ortygia. Of Ortygia. Probably the Greeks called it Ortygia. O-R-T-Y-G-I-A, the Isle of Ortygia. It's later changed to Delos, which is the sacred isle. What did Zeus do then? Well, in time he returned to the house of Helios, and this time he came to ask for my love. I, who am Helios' second daughter, I did not please Zeus, you see. That is why I was made spouse of Zeus, and that is why you are come to earth, Apollo. How glad I am that you were bold, Mother Leto. Boldness? Perhaps. Let me tell you how my sister still took part in your birth. In my late pregnancy, I roamed from land to land, asking to be received for a place to give birth, and all the lands rejected me, for they feared retaliation from Lady Hera, official wife of Zeus. At last, I came to Ortygia in the middle of the Aegean Sea. And as I looked upon this barren, rocky isle, I slowly recognized it. Why, this is my sister. Then Asteria greeted me fondly, she who was so far away from all she had known, and she who was so desperately lonely. And she begged me to stay and give birth here upon her barren self. Now I hesitated, for the ground was hard and the sun beastly, and the island floated in a way you couldn't predict. Yet I was desperate, for my pains came over me. So I agreed to stay, and the god Poseidon arrived and anchored the island with four great columns to the sea's floor. The ground of Apollo and Artemis's birth was forever made firm and established, and I knelt upon the ground and grasped the palm tree. And then there was a second gracious act from Poseidon. He brought the waves up over my head in a canopy of waters. It made a birth cave, primordial as Rhea's cave. Are you going to tell me why Asteria laughed when I was born? In that moment that I gave birth, I believe she was remade, for she herself passed from a barren ground to the sacred birthplace. This place is now called Delos. Apollo, never forget that you are the child of two mothers. Stop with that. Now, I'd just like to see what, you know, have you speak to any images that have come to you out of the story, or that seem important to you, that you have a connection to these very opposite natured sisters, but both taking part in the birth of this divine child. Yeah. Yeah, right. That both hold up the next layer, too. I like the wedding cake image. Right.
If you would just tell us a union of two parts of the family.
Yeah.
One
out of the union. Yes. 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 Okay. Right, right.
Also, the two parts of the soul that you're talking about.
Yes.
The receptive part and the part that leads away.
Yes. Could you all hear that? The receptive part of the soul and the part that runs away.
This isn't an image, but if Zeus is the light. And there has to be receptivity for the birth of the divine child, and yet some of his unions, were all of them always receptive? And in order to bring that, does there have to be conscious receptivity?
He didn't win all his loves.
But there were children born out of...
There were many.
Unions,
many. Oh, many, yes.
That was just going through my mind. What would be the significance of those types of births? The divine child, the semi-divine child, the one that led, and then just after the nurture.
Yes.
Just have to do that when if Zeus makes the decision, as you say, there is no argument.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's all up to Zeus, according to the myths.
Okay.
I have to learn it from the myth. Yeah. I think it's up to the human soul. And there, he was sometimes turned down. He was turned down by Asteria. Mm-hmm. It's true, there was a destiny here that worked itself out. You're right. So the birth happened.
So there's a power even beyond Zeus. There's a faithfulness that even Zeus cannot
have anything. Right. And that you find a bowing through all the myths, even myths of Zeus, to a kind of unifying, I hesitate to say something so rational, but like a bigger comprehensive destiny. Mm-hmm. The Greeks simply called it the fates.
Which is a feeling of color, mm-hmm. the overriding mm-hmm. masculine gene.
Well, it's a great cosmic, yes. Yes, and it's a great self force. What else do you feel in that now? Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking about the image of Asteria as being so barren and the rigid ground concrete. Mm-hmm. I just keep thinking about that and wondering how that fits. And I think, too, that the only thing that caused her to be anchored was when Poseidon anchored her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems, like you say, maybe I'm getting too rational here, trying to figure it all out, but it just,
no.
I just wonder about her person, and it seems immensely unhappy to be floating around.
Yes.
Just without anger, without
right.
any receptivity, any productivity, you know, mm-hmm. any creativity. Rigid to the ground, dry, barren, mm-hmm. and that it took some other force to cause any changes, or she wasn't able to do it herself, that she caused these other changes up to that point, but she couldn't or wouldn't cause any more changes for herself mm-hmm. to take care of herself. The others were taking care of herself because she was frightened. But then she got rigidified into a position where she couldn't help herself and didn't want to or something. She seems very desperate.
Yes. It was a very barren, kind of outcast place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. And I think we get this in our psyche. We get these islands. Yes.
Well, I think it's barren, but it has, to me, the palm tree is a phallic symbol, rising straight up, but the lake is a cauldron. This receptive mm-hmm. symbol, so they're both there,
mm-hmm.
but they're not, they don't seem to be able to come together until they're,
yes.
first of all, there's the, it's like a family being split, it's sort of sisters, mm-hmm. it's the effects of being sisters,
yeah.
bringing them together, and then the game for them, mm-hmm. it just becomes complete.
Right, but you feel the promise in the tree and the, mm-hmm. and the lake.
Well, I think the trees so often are a feminine symbol because they reach down into the ground, but just because of the view of it was an upright, Apollo vision of it was this upright that was mother, and yet
right.
at the same time could be a phallic symbol.
And very much a very early goddess symbol. The tree was always present to the early goddesses and the pillar, surprisingly. In ancient Crete, both the pillar and the tree are present at anything that constitutes a worship place for the goddess. Yes.
My sense is that the nocturnal one gives birth to the child on a much more primordial level than the ritual one.
Okay.
And I'm fascinated by the multiple transformation. She runs away.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes a coil.
Mm-hmm.
She turns into the island.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the force of Poseidon who brings the anchor, but also the water.
Yes.
What you call the cave.
The cave of water.
And out of that cave, Apollo comes.
Mm-hmm.
I can also see it as very much in parallel, but on a more primordial level.
At a more primordial level. It's very helpful. So you're saying that, that the nocturnal one really gives the primordial birth, the deepest level of birth.
That's how I feel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's no birth of both of those aspects.
No.
And that thanks to the one who please creates the sanctuary or
yes, the one who leaves creates the sanctuary. Uh-huh. Yes.
The fairness is a just right for the essentialist, but purity.
From some conscious point of view, it feels empty or barren. From some conscious point of view, but it does have this potentiality that is there. I think we feel this, All right, back here.
I have a connection to the story of Psyche and a rule until we have faces. Because it's the complement of the two sisters. That one thing is going on underground, and the other thing is kind of going on in a practical, containing sort of way.
Yes.
And in that whole process of those two sisters' different destinies, really, they're transforming each other the whole time.
Yeah.
And it feels like these two sisters are doing,
The same thing. There's a real, what was the word you used? They're transforming each other.
And complementing each other. Mm-hmm. Separate journeys.
So at some future point, you get more of an integrated or whole feminine amalgamation.
And then the birth is dual, too.
I think we need a little less sunlight.
The birth is dual.
The birth is
dual.
That's right. The birth is dual.
Yeah.
Actually, the firstborn is Artemis. Thanks. That's great. That's great. Thanks. Right. Oh, wait. I want to hit. Okay.
One of the things that strikes me is the conception of the sea as the original home of human beings and biologically. And if you think of the island floating on the sea, then you're not in the sea or in the land. Either one is a transitory place. So when Poseidon intervenes and creates a structure of connection, then now you have some grounding, but you're neither really land or sea. So then the canopy comes, and now you're partially in the land and partially in the sea due to Poseidon's double intervention. And now you're in the
turn. All right. And does it not say something to you about how within the cave of waters, how much in the depths the birth, it's taking place in a way that affects consciousness, but it is still withheld within the depths, the primordial depths, still in some important way. No, that's okay.
I took several images when you were reading it. One was of the, when she landed on the island, you made a statement about Hera would, she was afraid of Hera's revenge on whatever ground she took, so she'd been turned away from all these different lands. And ironically, because Asteria had left and had not allowed herself to be espoused of Zeus, she was protection in that sense because she had refused him and was protection against Hera's wrath. Hera would be less likely to attack the one who had turned him away.
I see. That's a very good point.
Something in that when you read that. Mm-hmm. And also the visual image of her turning in the birth, because she was totally alone, to grasp the trunk of the tree as part of her stability for the birth process itself. Yeah. And the wave, the cave, is like the flooding of the birth experience inside the earth. And it's transformative.
But that holding to the tree really gave her a real rooted thing into earth. Yeah.
And then you have the four. The four.
Four functions. Right. I believe this is the tale you read in the Delian hymn to Apollo. There are two Homeric hymns to Apollo, the Pythian Apollo, which refers to him at Delphi, where he's connected to the oracle, and Delian Apollo, referring to his birth and his worship on the sacred island of Delos. D-E-L-O-S, Delos, Delos.
Are those both by Homer?
Well, no, they are Homeric hymns. They come, many of them come from the Homeric age. Most of them do. I don't remember how old the Delian one is, but most of them are 7th or 8th century B.C. at least. But they don't know whether directly from Homer.
Sorry, you mentioned that Apollo himself seems to be such a kind of duality between Zeus and these two feather figures. I mean, he's as well as really this, and she tells him a more story. He bends down and touches the earth, and he has kind of willingness, and then possibility.
Yes.
Openness. It seems to me something, obviously, feels to me the way.
Apollo does, you know, he does later take over the sanctuary of Themis. That's why this little feeling of omen on the part of Themis in the story. She has this shudder when he says he'd like to have an oracle too. Now, the oracle she had at Delphi was the dream oracle. Those of you who came last night may have caught that. And she had, before Apollo ever came to Delphi, she had, which was called Pytho in those times, she had the dream oracle. People came and got their help through a dream. But when I started to say, even though he slew the python at Delphi, which was the central power around Themis, around the earth goddess, he paid a lot of honor and respect to earth. And he made a pilgrimage to honor earth right after this. So he had to restore something for his thrust, for this new thrust that consciousness was making, I would think, through Apollo. But he still had to get forgiven, as it were, or purified, the way the ancients said, of this guilt, of this guilt of slaying something that, some power of the earth. So anyway, that's just...
Well, it was a new oracle.
It was a descendant. It was a descendant of that dream oracle. He took over the place. He took over the power of the place. Remember, nature and spirit were not divided there. The place had held the dreams too, not just they're handed out like this from a god by a goddess, but they're there in the place. So, that is from an ancient or mythological point of view, they are. So he did inherit this oracle. Well, he took it over. Yes.
Talking about the vision of a woman where she's dreaming of the Native Americans. He's working with an American woman, and she's dreaming of Native Americans in her psyche. He says that the unconscious takes on, just like the Catholic Church, to go over the rituals of all the places where they moved in and assumed the culture of the local place, that those symbols became active then in that religion. And so Apollo would have to take into his own unconscious that which he had killed off in another form. He then becomes responsible to that energy in a bit less through his own unconscious context.
Yes.
It's simply like a dream of killing, but dismembering the honest. When you cut off the fantasy.
It didn't work.
Right.
But that's right, and he does absorb this, what's in that place. Well, I think it's important to, we're going to have to take a break, but to pay attention to especially the nocturnal one, the asteria in one's own psyche, in oneself, that flees from what is to come, flees from the new, is fearful. She has to be honored somehow, not rebuked, but honored, and she has to play out her reservation and she has to play out her many forms. She goes into the bird form. She's able to flee under the bush or into the thicket. Did you never, when you got bored or overwhelmed with something, go into the thicket of daydreams or the thicket of other things to amuse the consciousness or to take one away? Asteria has to play out her need and her viewpoint, her perspective. It isn't as if Leto has to win over her. Even the myth doesn't tell it that way. Leto has to come through too. But I do think that Asteria has been somehow wooed by Zeus in an important way, initially courted by Zeus, has received something that has to come to fruition. And this often lies in a side of ourselves that we don't want to disturb or look at, or we feel very inferior about. Often it's a side we feel very inferior, inadequate about. It's not the side that makes brownie points with anybody or with scores up and gets written up in the newspapers.
You know, a little aside to that, the four columns from the University of Washington, which were saved from the early Yukon exposition, and then they were saved, and now then somebody bought them and put them in the little park building. I think that's kind of interesting.
Really?
Deep, way down.
Right.
They did save those four columns instead of five or instead of three.
Yeah.
And you know they're in a little park downtown. Every time I see this,
you can go there and contemplate the birth of Apollo as well as the birth of the University of Washington or whatever. All right.
The river of water.
Oh. But having this finding again and again the liaison that's possible between the ready, fertile one, and I don't mean intellectually defined it, or between the ready, fertile one and the fleeing, barren one, if that's the way you want to talk about those opposites, in the soul, a very, very important. And I was very struck the first time I ever went to the little museum at Eleusis in Greece, which was the place of the mysteries, the great mysteries. I was very struck by one statue that's almost whole. There's very little that was saved that was whole from there. And it's the statue of the fleeing maiden, the fleeing Cori. And she's looking behind herself, and her garments are flowing out behind her. It's artistically a very powerful statement. And it's not terribly large, but she's looking behind her because she's pursued by Hades, Lord Hades, because that would be Persephone, would it not? She didn't want it either. But in that case, Hades sort of won out. But there is, again, the asteria aspect, and I think it's an essential soul attitude. And it has an instinct in it that we need to honor. That the, in the fleeing, it's not that she's wrong and Leto's right. To carry the opposition, to carry the duality here, is very important in one's dream work, I think. Somehow, too. And respect both sides of oneself in that. Yes, Daphne, right. She fled from Apollo. Well, often Artemis was seen in the fleeing maiden. They said she was. It was like Artemis. Daphne was seen as a kind of Artemis in the fleeing. So this is a very important part of us, and it's a part that has such an inner perspective, I think, such a deep, primordial inner perspective that we need it. Yeah.
What strikes me is that Asteria is welcoming Leto. She wants her there, yeah. And Leto looks down and sees the barren nature, and she doesn't want to go to a place of refuge. It's only when necessity forces her there, yeah, and the pain starts, right, she finds a welcoming. For some reason, that just keeps... At that point, you know, we've seen Asteria as the fleeing one, and now she's the one that's trying to welcome the barrenness. Welcome.
Yes.
Life bringer.
Which is a real turnaround.
Yeah. And the life bringer is like, no, I don't want to be there. It's too barren.
Yes.
And when she does finally, out of necessity, is forced there, then that almost forced union at that point brings about something good for both of them.
Really does. And if you want further connection to that, I suggest you read the dealing in him to Apollo, and the conversation between Leto and Asteria is quite long in that hymn. The conversation between Asteria and Leto, and Asteria is fearful when she's glad to have the birth take place, but she says, "I'll never amount to anything. People will never come here for you to see or worship your child, your divine child, Apollo, because this is such a poor place." And Leto has to assure her, "Nonsense, you know, this is going to be a great place." And though it was a barren island, it was the sacred island, became the crossroads. It's the very center of the wheel, the hub of the islands in the Aegean Sea, of the Cyclades, it's as though all the islands circle around Delos. And it was a place of great worship and rich treasure brought as gifts to Apollo. So I suggest you read that and feel how hard it is for that inferior side to think about having a bright future. And this is true. This is a basis for true optimism, not a floating, silly optimism, but something in the inferior side, when reclaimed and brought into the whole movement of the birth and the emergence from the psyche, is this very hopeful future. Bring in as an insight, or before we leave this particular material, and anything as an insight or an image you want to show us, or anything else?
Everybody.
Oh, good. Good.
Only is something because as long as you're good, you know it's great.
Maybe you can hold it up. So. Yes, how about...
This is my moon and the nocturnal, and this is a little quail, and I'm not sure how that looks, but that's the palm tree. And this is the fleeing.
Uh-huh.
And the little oranges are the little islands where the other sister tried to find the haven. She finally comes up here, here's the lake that comes in and the four columns, and he says, I will make a difference.
Oh, I will make a difference. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That helps. That's great.
This is just a, I first am struck with the palm and then the waves and the cave that it makes and then the voice of the energy that came out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Looks like a dancing palm tree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Moving to an island.
Last Monday I was there and the shelf was off the island and the turn around and the mountain was literally and I was walking with a friend along the road up and we were able to watch and kind of identify a small turn of bone carcass, but down the water it was black, and then it would swoop upward, and when the sun catched up, and the light would show, and it quickly mounted to the passage and went to dark, and I kept seeing the living room in the circle, and it just the way that it would. So it would keep going, and so this went on for about 5 minutes, it was just absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have such an island setting to bring to all this. Yeah. Yeah, one could do a great deal with that winged aspect of Asteria. Mm-hmm. All right, anything else? Yes, Lynette. Yes.
And technically right. That there's a part of me that just constantly flees from that. And it's and it's really has something to do with my inferior function and it's very hard to get to it. And so there's a part that just keeps escaping so that I can't just nail it down and get the job done.
No, no.
And I think what I'm feeling here is more of a respect this morning for that part that just will not get nailed down and won't cooperate in the straight, in the direct route to that task. And it gives a little more dignity to the what feels like it just won't get finished, it won't fulfill, it won't, I can't be so diligent about it and just get the job done. So I'm sensing that maybe that opens, some relaxation in me to
right.
just allow that part to also be playing a part that I don't see.
And to have a voice somewhere.
And to have a voice.
Have a voice somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Wow. And as you say, you experienced it not as an inferior side, but still a side that won't cooperate or won't enter it.
But it does have something to do with me trying to access my inferior function. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of resistance, and that would be the fleeing part, the resistance to, having to nail myself down and really work on that and try to get that activated somehow. And it's resisting, terribly.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
But the conflict, though, is that you said you're trying to get it technically correct?
No, I'm trying to bring something into concrete form. I'm trying to give form to thought.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a project.
It's a project, yeah. It's a project of trying to bring up thoughts that are, my thinking is my inferior function, so my thoughts sort of think themselves. And it's very hard for me to give form to that because they keep escaping too. They keep fleeing.
Mm-hmm.
And not, they're like the island that just kind of, won't stay put.
Mm-hmm.
So I get into that conflict of wanting to get it to stay put and come into something concrete and realize itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And often one will find that that asteria side, that nocturnal side, really will is what will bring the texture, that's one word that comes to my mind, or the richness, the real savor of what you're doing. Because she also stands in shadow. I mean, I didn't say she's the personal shadow, but she stands in shadow. And so she brings something very much deeper in the self world that she stands on.
Because she will try to speak in metaphor.
Yes, maybe.
She'll bring that, which is what the writing is.
Yes.
I just think about the associations that we have with the stars and far away and wanting to flee our present situation of people being starry-eyed and, and the work in art therapy around identifying sometimes in children's drawings or other people's drawings the presence of star images and wishing to be in another
place. That helps. So it is, that does sort of relate to the fleeing aspect, doesn't it? Escaping, fleeing aspect. But also it's a refuge aspect to it.
And the little prince was just mentioned.
Right, the little prince, yes, with his planet. And
I think what's confusing, though, is that there are times when it's really necessary to take the kind of prayer or quella aspect and discipline it and bring it into some kind of cooperation with the fuller personality. And that dividing line between...
Yes, but that's still different from the Asteria aspect. And the very fact that Asteria takes the form of Earth in her last transformation makes me really think she carries a large measure of earth potentiality, of life potentiality in that respect, the life of the psyche, the deep roots of the psyche. And without her, the product is too thin, correct, workable, utilitarian, or whatever, but doesn't have... as much of the soul world. The soul world does, its nocturnal aspect is perhaps its most important aspect. It's no accident that so many of the goddesses were moon goddesses, because, and even Athena's helpfulness towards the self, it occurs in one of the statements this afternoon, Athena's helpfulness on the journey, a lot of it has to do with her owl eyes, her owl vision, her vision in the night, her vision out of a nocturnal place, but looking on world and practical situation with nocturnal eyes. Athena, we don't think of as a nocturnal type, but she certainly had a nocturnal bird, and she had certain nocturnal rites. So that is, that's where she is immensely helpful to the hero, I think, with a certain nocturnal knowledge that she brings to bear on the practical situation. Yes. Right.
But he's and form. Around. I mean, it seemed like for the first time I Apollo and Hulk.
Had something in the ground.
Yeah, a feminine part of Apollo that I've never really.
And Apollo wore the laurel crown, always reminding himself of his connection to his beloved Daphne, who transformed herself into the tree that bears her name, the laurel tree. To escape his love. So there was a love that, where the god didn't get his way, so to speak, his first way. And yet, I think he brought an enormous consciousness. You feel the consciousness of the laurel even in the ritual at Delphi and throughout. And the fact that he wore it as a crown seems to me a connection to the feminine in some powerful way for him.
We're talking about this something I to take with me. But it seems to me that you have an element there where one has to go to this kind of deserted place, this empty place to get birth. You kind of do it in the confused world or wandering, you know.
Yes.
It seems to be much more difficult. And that sense of place that you have to be some place. Because the struggle to make oneself concrete, to create of oneself, for me, is very much frustrated that by not being worthy, probably as much as it's spiritual. And she goes there to give birth to a sister, because the birth sister didn't want to go there. Mm-hmm. Sister, you want to give birth. It's like, well, it doesn't make sense logically. One would have to go to this place. This drifting place, but it's definitely a place, a particular place, not a place of a lot of growth.
It has to quit drifting, though.
Right, it does when.
It has to quit drifting in order to do anything there and to bring a birth out of it.
But that happens when she comes there, when all those things are.
But those things have come, are concurrent. Right.
There's something about the dream, which I think was also getting with a kind of relaxation in the way.
Mm-hmm. You feel that as a...
Maybe a signal for the relaxation.
I see. Maybe there needs to be a relaxation. Especially in an undertaking or a project where that comes up.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.